Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's webinar, Tips and Tools, Preventing, Detecting, and Reporting Financial Exploitation in Long-Term Care Facilities. This is Amity Overall-Lade, Manager of Ombudsman Program and Policy with Consumer Voice. We're going to cover a lot of information today, so I'd like to review a few housekeeping tips and then get started. During the webinar, all lines are muted. If you have a question, please post your question using the chat feature on the left side of your screen. You will have an opportunity to submit questions for our speakers after both presentations. When it's time for open discussion, we'll ask you to raise your hand. That function is also on the left side of your screen, and we'll tell you how to unmute your line before speaking. Also, if you may have just heard, the webinar is being recorded. The webinar recording, PowerPoint slides, and other materials will be available on the Consumer Voice and NORC websites in the near future. The purpose of today's webinar is to introduce new resources and tips for preventing and responding to incidents of financial exploitation in long-term care facilities. We will hear from our speakers first, Naomi Karp, Policy Advisor for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Office of Older Americans, and then Anne Maria Beard, Deputy Director, Office of Supplemental Security Income and Representative Payment Policy for the Social Security Administration. Then we'll have time to ask questions after both speakers present. Then we will review and discuss an example of potential financial exploitation, and then all participants will have the opportunity to respond to a few discussion questions in order to share some best practices, advocacy strategies, and challenges related to investigating financial exploitation in long-term care facilities. In order to get an idea of who's on the line with us today, if you would take a moment and respond to this question and identify yourself. Are you a long-term care consumer or resident, an ombudsman, a family member, a government employee, long-term care provider, member of law enforcement, attorney, or other? Give you a couple more seconds to respond to that, because I'd like to see who we have on the line today. Great. It looks like the majority of the people on the line today are ombudsmen, but we have some government employees, some providers, excellent, attorneys, and a lot of other individuals. So thank you all so much for joining us today. We're going to have a very lively discussion and a lot of different perspectives and views, so that's great. There have been countless newspaper headlines, studies, hearings, and reports on elder abuse and neglect, and the number of stories involving financial exploitation are on the rise. A lot of outreach and education about financial exploitation is focused on elders and vulnerable adults living in their own home or with family members. However, they are not the only victims of financial exploitation. Financial exploitation occurs in long-term care facilities as well, both in nursing homes and assisted living, or also known board and care homes. Our staff often hear stories from long-term care consumers, ombudsmen, family members, advocates, providers, and others about financial exploitation in long-term care and the barriers they encounter in preventing, detecting, and responding to exploitation. Lack of education in preventing and responding to it, and issues with representative payees are two of the most common issues we hear of in facilities. Therefore, we've invited Naomi and Anne Maria to share information about these common issues. So looking at the prevalence of abuse, it's estimated that 1 in 10 elders experience some type of abuse in their lifetime. Only 1 in every 23 cases are reported. As many as 1 in 2 individuals with dementia are victims of some form of abuse. And family, friends, and caregivers are the perpetrators of abuse in 70 to 90% of all types of abuse. Specifically, in regards to financial exploitation, the illegal or improper use of an older adult's money or belonging, it's the fastest growing form of elder abuse, and it's grossly underreported. I wanted to give you an idea of what we see, what ombudsmen see and report as in regards to financial exploitation in long-term care facilities. Looking at the 2012 National Ombudsman Reporting System statistics, I found that in nursing homes, 8% of the complaints against facilities regarding abuse were about financial exploitation. and financial exploitation complaints involving a family member or another individual not associated with the facility are more than twice the number of any other type of abuse by family member or others. Board and Care is similar. 16% of the complaints against the facility regarding abuse were about financial exploitation, and financial exploitation complaints involving a family member or another individual were nearly three times the number of any other type of abuse by family members or others. There were a total of 193,650 complaints in nursing homes and board and care facilities in 2012 in the Ombudsman reporting data. So complaints about financial exploitation in these settings were about 2% of all complaints. However, these are only the financial exploitation complaints that Ombudsman are both aware of and, two, have received consent to investigate by the resident or resident's legal representative. Also, the primary responsibility of the Ombudsman program is to investigate and resolve complaints on behalf of residents to resolve the complaint to the satisfaction of the resident or complainant instead of seeking to substantiate a complaint by gathering evidence to prove it occurred, like the state survey agency or Adult Protective Services. Therefore, the Ombudsman may not be aware of or involved in some cases involving allegations of financial exploitation. So I'd like to hear from you really quickly before we move to Naomi's presentation. What type of financial exploitation do you hear the most about in long-term care facility settings? I'll give you just one more moment to respond. Okay, looks like the majority is misappropriation of funds. And then second after that would be theft, and third, inappropriate billing or charges. Thank you, that's really interesting. Now that we've provided the highlights of the prevalence of financial exploitation in facilities and discussed the need for more information and training, Naomi Karp will present and provide a brief overview of financial exploitation, explain the role of CFPB, share tips for identifying and responding to financial exploitation, and introduce some educational resources that you can use. So, Naomi, to unmute your line, please hit star 7.
Okay. Hi, everyone. This is Naomi Karp at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Office for Older Americans. I'd like to start out just by thanking Consumer Voice for putting on this webinar on this very important topic, and also thanks to all of you for dialing in. I know there was a huge amount of interest in this webinar. So, Amity, you can move on to the next slide. So this is, being a government agency, this is our disclaimer, essentially just says that what I'm telling you is not legal interpretation or guidance from the Bureau, and that a lot of what I'm going to say is not reflected on the slides. So Amity pretty much gave you the overview of what I'm going to cover. I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about the Bureau and about my office in particular. Then I'll get into some more background on financial exploitation, and Amity did a great job on setting the stage on that. We'll give some tips on prevention of financial exploitation and scams. And then I'm going to spend a little time talking about three resources that our office has created, actually two that are in existence now that I hope you'll all take a look at and that you'll find helpful, and one that will be of particular interest that we're in the final stages of creating and we hope to be out this year. So just starting out, for those of you who don't know, because we're quite a new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a federal financial regulatory agency that was created in the Dodd-Frank Act during the financial crisis. It's similar to a lot of other federal financial regulators, but it's unique in that its focus is totally on the consumer. As you can see from our mission on the slides, make markets for consumer financial products and services work for Americans. And then it talks about some of the, what is a consumer financial product or service, things like mortgages, credit cards, other banking products. And then we also regulate and enforce a lot of non-bank services and products, things like debt collection, payday lending, money transfers, credit reporting, and other things. So there are a lot of other functions that our Bureau has that I won't go into today, but you can explore our website at consumerfinance.gov and get a lot of great consumer-friendly information. In fact, our core functions, the first one we list is educate, and then we also obviously enforce the law and study it. So moving on to the next slide, I will talk a little bit about our office. The Office for Older Americans was actually specifically created in the legislation because Congress and advocates thought that older Americans needed a special office to help them maintain and preserve and achieve financial security in their later years. So our mission is to help consumers age 62 and over to get financial education and training they need. And we have kind of two buckets of issues that we address. The first, in the language of the statute, is prevent unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices aimed at seniors. We view that very broadly. That is financial exploitation and scams. The second set of issues are to help older people achieve later life economic security, so help them make decisions about retirement, about the kinds of benefits and assets that will support them in their retirement, and so forth. We like to say we're the only office in the federal government specifically dedicated to the financial health of seniors, and so we have a lot to do. Next slide, please. So here I just wanted to give you a quick screenshot of our website, as I mentioned before, consumerfinance.gov. If you were to go on our website and go under the third tab from the left that says Get Assistance, you would get a drop down and you could click on Older Americans and it would bring you to this page. Just wanted to point out a couple of other things very quickly about this page. If you can see all the way to the right, it's a little blurry. In green, it says Submit a Complaint. We do take directly or from advocates complaints about consumer financial products and services, and we try to help get them resolved. We've already taken over 300,000 complaints in the short time we've existed, so that may be something you may want to look into for yourself or for the people you represent. Also on our Older Americans page, there are links to some of the products that I'm going to talk about today, and you can also link to our blog. So now let's move on to talk about financial exploitation. Next slide, please. So Amity already reviewed this, so I'll go through this pretty quickly. A very general definition here, illegal or improper use of an older adult's funds, property, or assets. I do want to point out that there's not one single definition of what elder financial exploitation is. In fact, a lot of the law regarding elder financial exploitation is state law, and so from one state to another, you will find some variation. So if you are going to be working on these issues in your state, you would want to become familiar with, for example, how your state defines financial exploitation in its Adult Protective Services statute, and also in terms of the criminal laws. Some states have an actual crime of financial exploitation. In many other instances, you would use other criminal statutes like those for theft or embezzlement or other financial crimes. As Amity mentioned, financial exploitation is the most common form of elder abuse, but only a very small fraction of incidents are reported. There was a very interesting study in New York State a few years ago called Under the Radar. The title really tells you and emphasizes this point. They found that for financial exploitation, only one in 44 cases were ever addressed by agencies that have the capacity to help victims. That's a pretty tiny percentage. So who are the perpetrators? Well, pretty much everyone. So I've listed some here. Family members, and as Amity flagged before, a large percentage of the cases do seem to involve family members and people close to the victim. Caregivers, that means paid caregivers. It also means family caregivers, friends, et cetera. Scam artists, the strangers who attack people via the telephone, the internet, the mail, and so forth. Financial advisors can be perpetrators. Home repair contractors who make their way into someone's home and then rip them off. Fiduciaries, and we'll talk a little bit more about fiduciaries. That means people who have authority to manage someone else's money, and many others. So why are elders so victimized? Well, lots of reasons, but one is that they're attractive targets because in many cases that's where the money is. They may have significant assets in the bank or in other investments. They may not be cash rich, but they may have home equity. You know, many of them are at the stage of life where they have amassed that nest egg and someone wants to take it away from them. I think they're also targeted because they're vulnerable. And here you see quite a few reasons why they're vulnerable, and I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of this. In many cases, they're isolated, so when they hear from someone, they're happy to have the human contact. Cognitive decline, that makes people extremely vulnerable. We know that even with mild cognitive impairment, people's judgment to detect whether something is a scam or a fraud or a theft is really diminished. Physical disability, health problems, bereavement due to loss of a partner, a spouse, a friend, and so forth. All of these things make people vulnerable. Next slide, please. So, what are some common signs that financial exploitation may have occurred? Well, a lot of these are obvious, but I'll just kind of ding through them pretty quickly. So, someone close to the person or someone in a facility notices that money or property that used to be there is missing, or the individual may report, you know, hey, I used to have this much money in my bank account, now I only have this much, what's going on? So something's missing. The next set are sudden changes in spending or savings. So, for example, a large withdrawal without an explanation for what happened to the money. Using the ATM a lot, that one would really be a red flag, for example, if someone who has limited mobility is in a facility, and sometimes we see these ATM charges showing up when the person perhaps never used an ATM, or maybe ATM withdrawals in the middle of the night when we know this person is not going out. Another thing is all of a sudden the person can't pay bills that are usually paid. Then we have the sort of new best friend or the new person who is insinuating themselves into the situation and causing money or property to disappear. So if someone is suddenly making new or unusual gifts to family members, or this new person has shown up on the scene, perhaps it's changing beneficiaries to an insurance policy, changing a will, all of a sudden in a way that's uncharacteristic. And then we have a couple of things that are more about behavior that you might observe. Someone seems fearful of a relative, a caregiver, or a friend, or someone is isolating the person, keeping the older adult from having visitors or phone calls, perhaps in a social situation, and someone else will try to talk to Mrs. Jones, and Mrs. Jones's friend or relative keeps on jumping in and answering and doesn't let her answer for herself. So now let's move on to some tips for preventing scams. And here when I say scams, I'm thinking of this as kind of a subset of financial exploitation. These are typically the stranger scams. And you've all seen those happening, the fake lottery scams where people are convinced that they've won $1 million and all they have to do is send some fees and taxes up front and then they'll win it. The grandparent scam where you get the call from someone who's not really the grandchild saying, I'm in trouble, bail me out. The sweetheart scams, identity theft, fake government programs, there are endless kinds of scams. So here are just a few tips for preventing those scams. So first of all, clearly be very careful about account numbers, passwords, credit card information, social security number. We all know those things, but very important to share that and make sure the older adult is being very careful with those things. Responding to sales pitches, pressure tactics. Take time to compare things. Don't just fall for something. The old aphorism, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So again, just don't go for the thing that sounds so great. The time pressure, watch out for deals that are only good today, and if you don't act today, the deal is going to go away. Well, it wasn't a deal to begin with. Then again, getting back to things like these lottery scams, never pay up front for a promised prize. That's not how things work. If you win a prize, you won a prize. You don't have to pay for it up front. And then just watching out for signs that someone has already been scammed. Some of the things we talked about before, bank account balances going down, all of a sudden the person is receiving an increasing number of letters in the mail about sweepstakes, fake charities, et cetera. Once one scammer gets on to someone, they all come running and crowding around. So watch for those things so that you can stop the bleeding that may have occurred already. So now let's move on to a few tips for preventing or minimizing financial exploitation more broadly. And the first three things I have here are related to powers of attorney or other people who have legal authority to handle someone's money. Frequently, we do want to plan in advance so that someone trustworthy can handle our affairs if we become unable to handle them ourselves. So here are a few tips on powers of attorney or trust. Only appoint someone that you trust, and then verify, require them to report to a third party. You can do that when you create a power of attorney. You can actually write in a requirement that they must make an accounting to a third party and get some sunlight on it. Tell trusted other people about the arrangement so they can keep an eye out. Secondly, it's not written in stone. Any kind of arrangement that you set up, power of attorney or trust, you can change it. As long as you still have capacity, you can revoke the document, you can change the person name to handle your finances. And a third tip, don't put people in a conflict of interest position. Don't appoint paid caregivers or helpers as your agent under a power of attorney, as your representative payee generally. Anne Maria will probably address that later. It's just good to keep those functions separate. Someone who's paid to help you is paid to help you, and someone else should handle your affairs. Again, we talked about the new best friend. Beware of this new best friend who offers to handle your finances. You might need some new best friends, but don't let them handle your money. And then just a few things, common sense, to avoid abuse by caregivers and people who are helping you in the home, in a facility, in an apartment. Make sure to secure your valuables, your documents, your credit cards, and your statements. Monitor them regularly, including your bank accounts and your phone bills. Don't let your caregivers have your credit card or your debit card for errands or purchases. Figure out another way to do it, cash. Just don't give them access to sort of an unending stream of funds. So those are just some tips, and now I'm going to move quickly into some of the tools that we have here at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and I'm going to talk to you about the problem we were trying to solve and then how we tried to solve it. And I'll try to go quickly because I know time is moving on. So the first is an initiative we call Managing Someone Else's Money. clearly, we talked before about the need to appoint someone so that if you're no longer able to handle your own finances, someone you trust can do so. People need a surrogate. And what we're calling lay fiduciaries, meaning someone who's not a professional, it's a family member or a friend, can be a critical source of help. But they often don't have any training, and some of them even steal your money. So, moving to the next slide, we created a series of guides. This is what they look like, and they're available on our website. You'll see in a later slide. You can download them. You can also get hard copies. Moving on to the next slide. Our initiative was to release a set of four guides called Managing Someone Else's Money, and they're for four types of fiduciaries: agents under power of attorney, guardians, trustees under revocable living trusts, and government fiduciaries like Social Security representative payees and VA fiduciaries. Next slide. So we talked a little bit about what is a fiduciary: anyone named legally to manage your money or property. And in the guide, we've divided their duties into four main duties. Act only in the person's interest and avoid conflicts. And we give some examples of what might be a conflict of interest. For example, if you buy a car with mom's money and maybe you drive her to the doctor once in a while, but the rest of the time you use it for your own needs and interests, that may be a conflict of interest and a violation of your duty. Manage the money and property very carefully. Keep the money separate. Don't combine it in a bank account. Have it in a separate bank account designated for that person. And keep good records. And the guides go into very practical explanations and tips on all of these things. Then the next section of the guides teaches these money managers to spot financial exploitation and to protect the person's assets from scams and frauds by third parties, and also to make sure they understand it so they don't do it themselves. Moving on to the next slide. This, you'll be able to access this PowerPoint later. This shows you the link for how you can download the guides and how you can also order them in bulk. These have been flying out the door. We've sent out 25,000 of each guide, and so we're ordering more, but you can place your orders here. Coming up, we're going to do some state-specific guides for six states. The states are listed on your slide here, and a replication manual for other states so that state bar associations, state agencies on aging, other stakeholders in those states can have an easy way to take our national guides and adapt them for their states. Because as I mentioned, a lot of the laws that govern these things are state specific. Okay, moving on quickly, because I know we're really coming short here. This is the one where I wanted to give you the heads up that it's coming. We are producing a national guide for operators of congregate facilities such as nursing facilities and assisted living facilities on identifying and intervening in financial exploitation cases. The guides will be aimed for administrators, people in the business office, social service, and admissions people. But we'll also have a lot of tips and curricula on training the entire staff of the facility. We want to give them the skills to identify and intervene in these cases and to have protocols for doing so. So that one's coming soon, sometime later this year. Keep your eye out for it. And now I want to move on to one last resource, and that is our Money Smart for Older Adults Prevent Financial Exploitation tool. Next slide, please. This is an initiative that our office and our bureau undertook with the FDIC, a bank regulator, that has a series of Money Smart financial education materials. And we teamed up because we thought we needed one for older adults. It's a train-the-trainer model. So we have an instructor manual that teaches people how to give trainings on preventing, recognizing, and reporting elder financial exploitation. Then we also have a participant guide that gives examples and activities, defines terms, and gives them resources. And that one is in very plain English, simple. Next slide. You'll see here what the objectives of the module are and what some of the topics are. It's a lot of what we talked about today, identity theft, planning ahead, planning for disasters, and so forth. And then moving on to the next slide, again, this will give you the links for finding the training module and upcoming events. That's on the FDIC's website. And then to order the participant resource guide, which is our publication that gives you the site. And finally, I have my contact information here. And again, I appreciate this opportunity. Our office also has a distribution list. From time to time, when something new or important is happening, we send out email blasts. If you're interested in being placed on our list, you can send me an email and I'll make sure that we are adding you to your list. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Naomi. Those were excellent tips and resources, and I hope everyone takes advantage of those resources when they're working with clients, consumers, and the public, so thank you. To mute your line, you can hit *6. I'm going to go ahead and move to the next slide, which is another poll. I'd like to know if you've encountered any issues with facilities serving as the representative payee for individuals. I thought that may be helpful for Anne Maria to hear before she presents. Okay, one more second to respond and then we'll go to the results. Okay, it's pretty close. About 57% said yes and 42% said no. So thank you so much. It's really helpful during this webinar to learn about your experiences. Okay. So now Anne Maria Beard with Social Security Administration will present and explain the representative payee program, including the responsibilities of the rep payee, who individuals can contact if they have concerns about a rep payee, and the role of the Social Security Administration in investigating allegations of misuse of this program. So Anne Maria, if you'll hit *7 to unmute your line.
Hi, everyone. This is Anne Maria, as Amity said. I work at the Social Security Administration in the area of representative payee policy. I'm very pleased to speak with you all today. As the poll question indicates, I think there are some topics and issues that we share in common and that we hope to establish and grow a good relationship with you all as a resource for identifying potential misusers and assisting us in protecting our beneficiaries. You can go to the next slide, Amity. I just want to give you a little background and some of the idea of the size of our program. Social Security appoints payees for all minor children, for anyone who is legally incompetent, and also for an adult who is unable to manage or direct the use of his or her benefits. And that's a critical piece. We know that some people may be physically limited and may not be able to get out and about and attend to paying bills and that sort of thing. But if they are capable of directing someone, hopefully someone they trust, as Naomi pointed out, that's a big issue, to manage their benefits and pay bills and assist them, then we consider that they are capable. Social Security has roughly 8.6 million beneficiaries who have representative payees. And of those, the payees, we have about 5.9 million people who serve in that capacity. So that's just to give you an idea of the size of the program that we have and the challenge in monitoring such a large group of people. Amity, can you go to the next slide, please? When we select a payee to assist a beneficiary, the main duty and our main concern is that this individual or organization will be aware of and sensitive to the beneficiary's needs and use his or her payments strictly to meet their needs. It's not to treat themselves to something else. It's strictly for the needs of the beneficiary. If there's any money remaining after they have paid the beneficiary's current expenses or met their needs, we ask that they use an interest-bearing account possibly, or savings bonds, or some sort of way to save, conserve the funds for the beneficiary. Payees are responsible for reporting any changes or events which could affect the beneficiary's eligibility for benefits or the amount that we pay them. Next slide, please, Amity. We ask that payees maintain records of all the benefits that have been paid and how they use or save those benefits. We expect them to provide that information as needed to social service agencies or medical facilities that serve the beneficiary. They are to help the beneficiary receive medical treatment when needed. They are responsible for notifying SSA of any changes in their own circumstances that could affect their ability or performance to serve as a payee. They complete written reports each year called accounting forms, and they are to return any payments to SSA that the beneficiary is not entitled to. I'd like to make a point that when we appoint someone as a representative payee, their responsibility is for the benefits that Social Security issues. We do not consider that as giving them access or the right to manage other income that the beneficiary may have or to make any legal decisions for the beneficiary outside of the funds that we pay. Okay, next slide, please. If you become aware of a representative payee who is misusing an individual's benefits, you should report it to SSA immediately. And I believe that many of you are in a position to be aware of these situations. As I pointed out, we do have a large population of beneficiaries who have payees, and we count on caring people such as you to alert us when they notice that something is amiss in a person's situation. Next slide, please, Amity. There are several ways that you can report misuse to Social Security. You may contact our toll-free number, 800-772-1213. We also have the TTY number listed there. You may contact the local SSA field office, or you can also contact our Office of the Inspector General. You can contact them by phone. The number is listed on the slide, 800-269-0271. Or you can report online at oig.ssa.gov and search for fraud. I'm glad that Amity pointed out this information will be available to you on the site. Those are the ways you can contact us. And as I said, we really count on caring people to be the eyes and ears for the agency. If you notice something in dealing with a beneficiary, we would like to know. Okay, next slide, please. When we receive an allegation of misuse, our agency documents, investigates, and resolves all of the allegations. We're required to, and we do so. If we do determine that someone has misused benefits, we must take further action, and those actions include usually removing the individual from the position of payee, obtaining restitution from the person who misused the benefits, and in certain instances, reissuing or repaying funds to the beneficiaries. And we do take misuse very seriously, so that in that instance, or because of that, we refer all cases of misuse to the OIG, to our Office of Inspector General, for possible criminal prosecution. In closing on our presentation, which was sort of short but to the point, the majority of information about our program is available at socialsecurity.gov. Again, we take these allegations very seriously. It's wonderful to hear the work that Naomi and her organization are doing to inform and empower people to protect themselves and also to protect their loved ones. And I'll be glad to take any questions when we're open for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Maria, very much. This was really helpful, and I know that we've already received several questions, so I know people are going to have questions for you in just a moment. So let's move to the Q&A portion of the call. So just to kind of cover the instructions for this again, you can send in a question through the chat feature, or you can raise your hand and then we'll call on you. So we already have a few questions in the chat feature, so I'm going to go to those first. And let's see here. There was a question, and I believe it was directed to Anne Maria, because I think it came through during your presentation. The question was, wouldn't you need to report it to APS as well? So I'm assuming that means if there seems to be abuse of the representative payee relationship, what would be your role at SSA in involving APS or any other entities? And to unmute your line, you can hit star 7 again.
Oh, just a moment.
Oh, there you go. I can hear you.
I'm here. Okay. For us, our focus, although we, again, are very concerned about the beneficiary's well-being, our focus tends to be on our benefits. We suggest that if the individual who is reporting to us about misuse also has concerns about abuse, now they can tell us and we can then contact Adult Protective Services or the appropriate organization or agency. But they could also provide that information. I think the key is that if they let us know that we have enough information to actually report and give Adult Protective Services what they need to pursue investigation on their part.
Okay, great. Thank you. And kind of a follow-up question to that. If a person says a beneficiary is unable to manage their own benefits, what evidence must be provided to you to justify that?
That is a great question, actually. Capability is what we focus on. And in general, and I know for our elderly beneficiaries who initially began to receive Social Security because of retirement, there's no disability evaluation or anything, so we don't usually address capability with them up front. If you have an individual family member who you've noticed a deterioration in their cognitive abilities or that they cannot manage their funds anymore, we would need medical evidence. And in general, when you come to us with this concern, we would initiate the contact with a medical professional, their regular doctor or medical care provider, to get feedback to determine if they are meeting, if they have had a loss in function and are not able to handle their financial responsibilities. And if possible, in addition to that, if the beneficiary is able to come into the office, we also give a great deal of consideration to what we call lay evidence, which is observing the person, communicating with the person, perhaps asking them questions that would indicate to us whether or not they are aware and in tune with their own needs and their financial management issues. So we do gather medical and lay evidence.
Thank you very much. Naomi, I see your hand is raised. Do you have something to add in response to those questions? If so, you can unmute your line by hitting star 7.
Yes, I just wanted to make a quick point. As Anne-Marie noted, Social Security rep payees have the responsibility for handling those funds, but many people may have other funds. It could be, you know, savings or other property. They might have other income, such as a pension. They could also be collecting VA benefits and so forth. So it's pretty common for someone to have more than one fiduciary handling their money. And it It also could be that one person is handling several fiduciary roles. So just for example, a person could have a court-appointed guardian, they could have a Social Security representative payee, and they could have a VA fiduciary all at one time. Or they might have appointed someone as their agent under power of attorney, but still need someone to be named as a Social Security representative payee to handle the Social Security benefits. So I just thought it was important for people to understand that. And when they're thinking about something like should they report to APS, Adult Protective Services, they might want to think about the fact that this person may be handling not just the Social Security assets, but other assets as well, and then it would be very appropriate to report to Adult Protective Services and to law enforcement if they think that a crime may have been committed.
Thank you, Naomi, very much. I'm going to go ahead. We do have several other questions in chat, and I will get to as many of those as possible, but we've had people with their hand raised, so I'm going to go to them. Bill Bard, I see your hand raised. If you'll hit star 7 to unmute your line, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Fred Steele. I'm the state legal services developer in Oregon. I'm sitting here with Bill Bard in Oregon and was curious about the referrals from Adult Protective Services or in general how many you're receiving for representative payees that have been substantiated as abusers and if there is a good flow of communication there.
This is Anne-Maria. I don't think that we track that if we maintain any what we call MI management information on those kinds of reports. So it's difficult for me to give a number.
Thank you. That's an interesting question, Fred. Thank you very much for that. Let's see. There's a question for Naomi. Is there a CFPB document that guides people on what to do if they see a family member being subjected to repeated scams? And Naomi, you can hit star 7 to unmute.
Hi, it's Naomi. Okay, so what to do if they see someone being exposed to repeated scams? That's certainly a very vexing problem. Unfortunately, we see a lot of people, especially with these lottery scams, who even when family members, you know, communicate with them, law enforcement communicates with them, APS communicates with them that it is a scam, we still see people being repeatedly victimized. I don't think we have a CFPB document that really deals with that very specific question. Our Money Smart talks about, you know, various steps that you can take when you see these kinds of things happening. But I know that that particular question is one that a lot of us at various federal agencies are grappling with. You know, how do we stop the bleeding? How do we address that when, you know, it seems pretty clear that a person may have some level of cognitive impairment or a change in brain functioning, and they just are repeatedly being scammed and continue to be vulnerable. And there's not really an easy answer, unfortunately. But I think just remembering all of those things about reporting to law enforcement, reporting to APS, reporting to various other federal agencies that might be appropriate. For example, if it's fraud through the mail, you can contact the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, and they have their own law enforcement. In our Managing Someone Else's Money Guides, in the back, we have a Where to Go for Help section, and it lists a whole variety of local, state, and federal agencies that might be appropriate for reporting.
Thanks, Naomi. Another question about rep payee, and I apologize if this was already addressed and I missed it, but what happens in the interim when a report has been made to SSA about an alleged rep payee abuse? Is a temporary payee put in place, or does the alleged abuser continue to have access to those benefits until it, you know, the case is investigated?
Just a minute.
Sure.
That's a very good question, and that can vary from case to case. If we look into it and it's immediately very clear that there is misuse, we would remove the payee immediately. Sometimes we have situations, I didn't go into the different kinds of payees, but in addition to individuals who may serve as payees, we also have organizations that serve as the representative payee, and the misuse allegation that comes in involves a particular employee. And usually when we find that out, the employee has already been removed by the organization. So the organization could potentially continue to serve if it's clear that the misuse is isolated to that one employee. So it does vary, but we do our best to take actions to protect the beneficiary. We don't have what we call temporary payees. We do our best if we're replacing or finding a new payee to find someone that will be willing to serve them long term. Just, I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. I think it does. And I'm going to go to the phone lines one more time because I see a hand raised, and then I have another chat question, and we'll see where that gets us as far as time. I see that Evie Curtis has a hand raised. If you'll hit *7 to unmute your line and ask your question, please.
This is Evie Curtis, and my question pertains, and I happen to be in the financial industry. I'm a trust officer. So my question is two-part. Number one is oversight on agents or representative payees. And number two, reporting to financial institutions. Sometimes we in the financial institutions don't know who to believe. It's difficult.
Thank you for that question about oversight, Evie. A lot of the chat messages were also about what type of oversight is there. For example, is there any kind of report on expenditures? Do they look, you know, report whenever they submit taxes? How does all that work? So I think a lot of people would like more information about that.
This is Anne Maria. Since the money is not the payee's money, it's the beneficiary's money, there are no requirements to report it to the IRS. They're managing the money. We do have annual accountings that are required of all of our payees with, I think, very few exceptions. The only exception to that would be state mental institutions. So we do get the annual reporting for our organizational payees who may have multiple beneficiaries that they are responsible for. We do have what we call on-site reviews, where we go in and review the books and records pertaining to a set number of beneficiaries. So that's the largest part of our oversight, is our monitoring and accounting in the payee world.
And this is Naomi. I just wanted to jump in on the second part. I'm not entirely sure what you meant by reporting to financial institutions, but if you're talking about the challenges faced by various financial institutions and financial services professionals, it certainly is true that, you know, it's really not always easy to discern whether someone is actually being exploited, whether perhaps another family member in a dispute is making an accusation that isn't true, or that something that looks like exploitation might really just be confusion or poor record keeping and so forth. I think we would still urge people in whatever role they're in, and that includes financial institutions, to make reports if they think that there is a good chance that there is some kind of exploitation going on, if they're making the report in good faith. Probably better to be safe than sorry. We know that APS, Social Security, law enforcement, and so forth are overworked and are challenged with resources, but we really do need to increase the reporting because, as you could see from the data we presented earlier, it's just so underreported, and the victims themselves so frequently will not report this because they're ashamed, they're embarrassed, they don't want to rat out someone in their family, they're afraid that people might put them in a more restrictive setting or might think that they are losing capacity. So there are just so many reasons people don't want to report themselves, and so it's so important for other people who are in a good position to spot abuse to make those reports.
Thank you very much. We have time for just one more question before we move to discussing the scenario and the other discussion questions. So it's kind of a follow-up question, actually, to what you were just talking about reporting any suspicion we have. And Anne Maria alluded to sometimes it being pretty evident immediately that there is abuse occurring. So is there what type of information would be most helpful when a person makes a report that there may be abuse of a rep payee arrangement? What specific evidence do you need that makes it really immediately clear?
This is Anne Maria. First of all, if you can have as much information as possible, if you have the person's, I think for many of you who are participating, you're in a position where you might have the person's social security number, name, that kind of information is very helpful to us. But if, for instance, you have a situation where you know that someone receives $1,000 a month from Social Security and their rent is $500 a month and all of a sudden they're being evicted for non-payment of rent, if it's clear to you in your observation that they seem not to be having their basic needs met, they are not, you know, it's the terrible weather we've been having here, you see the person is out and about without a coat, they're not properly clothed. That's really what the funds are for, to meet that person's basic needs, their food, clothing, and shelter. That's the key for our SSI beneficiaries. But for all of our folks, when we entrust their benefits to someone, that person is to use the funds to care for them. So if you, again, some of the things Naomi mentioned, all of a sudden they're receiving notices for non-payment of bills, that kind of thing, could indicate that someone who's been entrusted to manage their money is, in fact, misusing it and mistreating them.
Thank you, Anne Maria. Like I said, we do have some questions that we couldn't get to in the chat feature, so I will have all those questions once we conclude the webinar. And if it's okay with Anne Maria and Naomi, I'll forward them to them, and if we can get some answers, then I'll share that as part of the webinar materials after the webinar's concluded.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. Thanks, Amity.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think both Anne Maria and Naomi will be able to participate in our discussion and maybe even address some of those chat questions as we discuss these scenarios. So as I mentioned earlier, we'll now move to the discussion part of the webinar. We'll review a common scenario and share challenges and best practices. We may not have time to cover every discussion question, but they will be available on the slides for you to refer to after the webinar as you go back to your office and consider your next step in addressing financial exploitation. In order to hear from as many participants as possible, please keep your responses brief, and I'll keep us moving along time-wise. So a fairly common scenario we see is that a nursing home resident contacts you stating that she received a discharge notice for non-payment. She tells you that her son is her representative payee for her Social Security benefits and handles her financial affairs. So she does not understand why she is in arrears to the facility. She gives you permission to speak with her son and the facility to determine why she's in arrears as she does not want to be discharged. So we do have a variety of folks on the phone, so feel free to chat your responses to these scenario questions or raise your hand. I'd like to know how you would proceed in this particular situation if you were to receive this call. And to mute your line, you can hit *6. Anyone have any feedback? You can send a chat message or raise your hand. Okay. I received two chat messages. One said the primary interest is getting the bill paid first. One said contact APS, talk with the son. And we do have an APS worker on the line that said they'd immediately speak with the agent and then refer to SSA for a new rep payee. And another chat person said contact the ombudsman program. Excellent. So I think those are all very solid responses. Going to the billing department first and getting a copy of the charges, then go to the son. That's excellent. And another comment, I'd also follow through with the nursing home to make sure they had procedures in place to gather outstanding funds. It's fairly common, unfortunately, that say there's new administration at a facility and all of a sudden discharge notices go out and residents are $20,000 in arrears or $10,000 in arrears. It really begs the question why that wasn't caught earlier and addressed. Ask the son for copies of bank statements he's using to manage the funds and educate the son about legal requirements. I think those are all excellent responses and great approaches. What would you do if it appears that the resident's son did not fully understand his responsibilities and the issue was rather a lack of understanding instead of out-and-out financial exploitation? I see that Naomi has her hand raised, so Naomi, please hit *7 to unmute, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Hi, I was actually first going to add one more thing to the first question about how you would proceed. I think it's also important to remember that the person whose funds may have been misappropriated might need some legal representation, either because they're being evicted and they need to assert their rights so that they won't be evicted, or perhaps they want to try to get restitution for money that was taken away. I know Anne Maria mentioned that sometimes Social Security will repay funds, but, you know, there could be other funds that are not recapturable in that way. So always important, maybe not the first step, but maybe one of the later steps to make sure that person knows about how to find legal representation, especially if they may be eligible for free legal representation and you can refer them to those services.
That's an excellent point, Naomi. Thank you. And if the person that received this call was not an ombudsman but did reach out to the ombudsman program, then usually locally they do have some connections to legal services and could refer that person to legal services. So excellent point. I think those are all really great first steps in how to address it. And it looks like we have a few other comments. It seems the son's misunderstanding is irrelevant to having the resident's bill paid after securing the resident's place should look into counseling for the son or replacing him. Yep, absolutely. Would your approach change if, based on your discussion with the resident, she appeared to have some memory issues or cognitive deficits? And if so, how? Any feedback for that one? It would not change? Okay. I think that's an excellent point. I think involving taking all those steps, looking at the previous billing, speaking with the resident, speaking with the resident's son, and, of course, contacting any legal services or APS if it does seem to be actual exploitation, and contacting SSA. Absolutely. And then, of course, meeting with the nursing home and the resident and care planning, any kind of other supports if it does look like the resident's capacity is declining or mental faculties are declining. And looking at any kind of other advanced planning and having that dialogue with the resident. Excellent points. So one other quick question before we move to a poll question and some discussion questions not related to this scenario. Would your advocacy strategies differ if the resident lived in an assisted living facility than a nursing home? And, yes, I immediately, several comments about the major difference being that assisted living and board and care residents are not protected in the same way that nursing home residents are, since there are no federal regulations and there are a variety of a variation of state protections depending on what state you're in. So I still think all those steps that you would take and that we mentioned so far would be appropriate in taking this situation, although as an advocate, whether you're an ombudsman or some other advocate, it may be more challenging since the federal regulations aren't there to support the resident. So thank you so much for your feedback. So I would like to move just kind of to see what your barriers are in addressing financial expectation, your most significant barrier, because I think that this question will really add some depth to the response to the future discussion questions that we're about to go into. So what is your most significant barrier to addressing financial exploitation? Lack of criminal prosecution, no resident permission to proceed, lack of law enforcement involvement, or the resident lacks capacity to consent, or something else that we did not list. Give you a couple more seconds to respond. Yes, unfortunately, it looks like most of the respondents, the most significant barrier is no resident permission to investigate or proceed or report a suspicion of financial exploitation. So I think that definitely ties into the low number of complaints that are reported and the just gross underreporting of these cases. Thank you. So discussion question one, do you see differences in the types of financial exploitation, whether it's scams, healthcare fraud, identity theft, theft, inappropriate billing, in assisted living and board and care homes compared to nursing homes? And if so, what's the difference? And again, you can send a chat message or you can raise your hand and talk to us. One chat message that just came through was, there's a bigger problem in my area with rent payees who are owners or operators of assisted living homes. Versus nursing homes. Nursing homes have a good accounting practices, but assisted living facilities do not. Extremely valid point. And again, more problems with inappropriate billing, and it's all almost private pay. And yes, it's more prevalent in assisted living. We did receive one question, and if you're not speaking right now, can you mute your line by hitting *6? Thank you. We received one statement that operators should not be representative payees. And in assisted living facility, there's more direct caregiver access to personal funds. Again, excellent point. And that there's just, in general, more oversight with nursing homes when it comes to billing and personal finances of residents. Thank you. That's very helpful. I see that Alan has his hand raised. If you'll go ahead and hit *7 to unmute your line, Alan.
Hi, can you hear me? This is Alan.
Yes.
Well, I think I was responding to, it depends, you know, when you're talking about the nursing homes. In our state, APS is not, APS deals with financial exploitation of vulnerable persons who are living in the community, and not nursing homes. And I know it's different state by state, you know. And certainly, I just wanted to emphasize also that in our family-type homes for adults in New York State, which are the small adult care facilities, we don't permit operators to be rep payees because it's a conflict of interest. And we've had too many times in which there's been misappropriation of funds.
Wow. Thank you for that.
Okay.
Yes. As we said, everything, there's a whole lot of variety among the country in every state, but I was not aware that you did not allow operators to do that, so thank you for sharing that. We received another comment that there's a very difficult time in APS accepting and pursuing cases where the resident is in a nursing home or assisted living and the spouses in the community who's also having difficulty in scams. So does that mean that the spouse in the community also potentially could be exploited in addition to the spouse that lives in a facility? I'm sorry, I wasn't clear on that. If you want to raise your hand and clarify, that'd be great. If not, we'll go ahead and move to the next discussion question. Part of our webinar format, the reason we did leave so much time for discussion and Q&A and just sharing is that it really helps us at Consumer Voice and NORC to hear directly from you, not just about the barriers that you're encountering, but also the best practices and what you're seeing in the field, as it allows us to share across the country and really to craft any kind of upcoming training or resources. So we would like to know if you have seen some successful approaches that long-term care facility providers have implemented in order to prevent, detect, and respond to financial exploitation. Any best practices? Thank you, Evie. She said quicker action on reporting time for bills not being paid. Excellent. That's exactly what I was referring to earlier about individuals being in arrears and thousands of dollars and not notifying until months down the line. Also, she mentioned a partnership developed with local police and local financial institutions. That's excellent. That's a great best practice and something that every provider could do. And thank you for that comment about the need to train operators and staff on this topic. I completely agree. And I think, I hope that you walk away from this webinar with some resources that you could use individually and working with the community, as well as operators and their staff for staff and services and training. Okay, I don't see any other hands raised or comments, so I'm going to move to the next discussion question. We'd like to hear, because we do hear that working with local law enforcement, getting them to pursue these cases can be a significant barrier, so we'd like to hear how you've engaged local law enforcement in order to improve their response, investigation, and prosecution of financial exploitation. So if you have a comment, please raise your hand or send a chat message. I see a hand raised. I see Mary Jones has her hand raised. Mary, if you'll hit *7 to unmute your line. Hello, Mary? Okay. Well, Mary, if you want to speak later, that's fine, but I'm going to go ahead and move to the next person. Christina, your hand is raised. If you'll hit *7 to unmute your line, please.
Hello, Amity?
Hi. Hi, Christina. Hi. Thank you. Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. One way that we've have engaged our law enforcement is one of our nursing facilities, we had a pretty high percentage rate of residents that were having items taken. And of course, the residents didn't want us to file any complaints or to do anything. They said they would take care of it. I ended up contacting the local law enforcement just to see if they could do some type of presentation or something in order to try to talk to the residents and see if they can encourage them to file a report. And so they said that they could put something together, and it was called the Watch Program, and it's kind of like a neighborhood watch program. They came in and did a presentation. We had families, the residents, staff that were around. I mean, we had a very good turnout, and so, of course, the law enforcement came in with their uniforms, and it was very successful, and now this group of law enforcement officers are going to other nursing homes and actually talking on protecting their, items in the nursing home. So that's one thing that we've done.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's an excellent example of getting the local law enforcement directly involved in the situation. So thank you, and I'm glad it's working.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up an excellent question that Naomi mentioned, and that I was going to mention this reporting requirement a little further in the presentation, but you may or may not be aware that in the Elder Justice Act, there was a new reporting requirement that facilities, long-term care facilities, which includes nursing homes, receiving $10,000 or more in federal funds, are required to report any suspicion of abuse to local law enforcement. So I will go ahead and post that survey and certification memo on the website when we post this recording and other materials, because that'll be helpful for you to go and communicate with providers and make sure they're aware of that new requirement. So out of curiosity, if you could just send some chat messages, if that reporting requirement, if you've seen a difference. Are they communicating better with local law enforcement? Do you feel that more reports of suspicions of abuse are going into local law enforcement? While you're thinking about that, I wanted to share a couple other chat messages of examples of best practices. One person said they have a cooperative agreement with law enforcement and the DA office to pursue these types of cases. Excellent. Another chat message said that she was an active member of an elder and vulnerable adult abuse task force that involved local APS, police, the state's attorney, guardianship, and other multidisciplinary teams. So excellent examples. Thank you very much. So I'm going to move to discussion question number 4. And if you're not speaking right now, could you hit *6 to mute your line? Discussion question number 4 is, please share an example of how you've increased public awareness of financial exploitation. Hello, if you're not speaking, can you please hit *6 to mute your line? Thank you. And it looks like there was a chat message I missed from the first question that said that the Weinberg Center for Elder Abuse Prevention at the Hebrew Home at Riverdale provides trainings to local law enforcement about abuse. Excellent. Any public awareness best practices? It looks like there's a lot of chat messages about people being involved in multidisciplinary teams, so that's excellent. Or performing training. One person said they performed a training with all of the victim assistance officers throughout our city about signs of financial exploitation and creating better relationships with long-term care facilities in their districts, and that they're very fortunate to have victims assistance officers in every district of our city. And that reminds me, if you haven't explored the VOCA website for victims of criminal acts, check out that website because there's a lot of support and information for victims of crime, which also includes elder abuse. And so that would be another great resource for you. Okay, so let's see. Another chat person said they regularly present programs on the topic to consumers through churches, independent living centers, and banks. That's great. Senior health fairs also come to mind. Elder justice days include local politicians in order to get a lot of media attention. That's a great strategy. And there's a public awareness event in a group called Seniors in Law Enforcement. That's great, too. And, of course, another person via chat mentioned World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which I'll talk about in a few slides. Oh, and thank you, Kay. Kay said that in Missouri there's a video available online and a DVD for awareness of financial exploitation. So, Kay, if you wouldn't mind after this webinar if you could send me the link to that, because I will include that in the resources if people can use that in their local programs and state programs. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to the next discussion question, and then we'll go to close. Which organization, agency, or group have you found to be absolutely essential to collaborate with in order to address financial exploitation? I would say local law enforcement. And any other suggestions? Legal services? Yes. Communication with district attorneys? City attorney? The banking industry? Absolutely. And there's a lot of great training out there for the banking industry as well that's already created, so you don't have to reproduce anything. Yes, the AG's Medical Fraud Control Unit, which, again, I'll talk about in a couple slides. Thank you for bringing that up. Financial professionals, great point. The General Aging Network, and, of course, the Ombudsman Program. Thank you. Those are all great tips and people to coordinate with. So one last question before we move to my closing slides. How will you use today's information in your work to educate consumers, family members, and long-term care providers about preventing, detecting, and reporting financial exploitation? I'm curious if you've given any thought to that and how you're going to move forward after today's discussion. And I'll let y'all think about that for a minute, and I'll go through the next few slides. If you have any ideas, feel free to chat them or raise your hand. So in my closing slides, I wanted to just provide a recap of what a lot we've already talked about. Of course, some indicators that we've already discussed about financial exploitation includes unpaid bills, lack of necessities, clothing, shoes, toiletries, etc., gifts to staff, pressure from family members or friends to sign documents immediately, and missing personal possessions. A report by MetLife said that there were three different types of financial exploitation, and I thought these were maybe really helpful to you all as far as a preventative measure, because if facilities are really providing resident-centered care and get to know the resident, hopefully these kind of warning signs of the three different types could prevent something from happening or at least detect it quickly so it can be addressed. So the three different types include a crime of opportunity, where the person is just victimized simply because they're a means to an end. A crime of desperation, the perpetrator is so desperate for money they'll do anything. This crime usually involves, unfortunately, family or friends, and many family members that commit this type of crime of desperation are actually dependent on the elder. So if they are cohabitating, or maybe the elder moved into a facility and the family member still lives in the elder's home, something of that dynamic. The third type would be a crime of occupation, meaning that trust is developed with the elder specifically to exploit them in the future. So again, kind of like Naomi mentioned earlier, often it's a new friend or a new romantic interest, or sadly often a trusted professional, maybe a financial planner or someone like that. The impact of financial exploitation, obviously there's significant harm to residents. There's emotional effects, depression, fear, withdrawal, a loss of dignity, a loss of their personal funds or property, a loss perhaps of their current housing if they're discharged from a facility due to non-payment, pain and suffering, a loss of trust and damaged relationships, and potentially some physical and medical issues due to the emotional strain of this type of situation. The cost of financial exploitation, a study in 2012 by MetLife estimated that the annual financial loss by victims of financial abuse to be at least $2.9 billion. That is a 12% increase since the 2008 estimate of $2.6 billion. And, of course, this includes costs to services such as and benefits such as Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, pensions, and even increases the cost due to extra hospitalizations and so on. Since we're discussing financial exploitation in both nursing homes and assisted living, and only nursing homes have federal regulations, and now as we've already discussed, state regulations differ across the country. I'm not going to discuss specific regulations for facilities regarding abuse. Rather, I want to highlight some general responsibilities and practices in order to help prevent and then intervene once they recognize something. Facilities, in order to prevent this type of abuse, staffing is critical. Appropriate and effective screening of their staff, which includes federal background checks, reference checks, including residents and other staff in the potential staff interviews, and then, of course, asking the potential staff how they would respond to abuse. Person-centered care, which we mentioned earlier, really know the resident and their history, understand their needs and preferences, and when they change, how to support them, and in order to notice any kind of changes or things that are going on. Discuss advanced planning, power of attorney, rep payees, and access to personal needs allowance. There needs to be solid and strong leadership, and that includes facility policies and procedures that include information about when staff need to report suspicion of abuse, who to report it to, how to do it, and so on. And there needs to be better communication about unpaid bills with residents and families. And just general ongoing communication with residents and family members about financial exploitation, what to look for, what to do about it. And again, providers need to reach out to local law enforcement, the Ombudsman Program, ATS, State Survey Agency, and SSA. Involve those partners. And of course, the action steps they need to take is stop the abuse, support the victim, report it, investigate it, and remedy it, and do their best to prevent it from happening again in the future to somebody else. So how can you help? Well, you're here today, so you're already doing something about it. You're learning more about financial exploitation. So identify key resources that not just you can utilize, but also your staff, your volunteers, you can share with consumers and others. Speak with residents about their rights and the facility's responsibilities. Share information regarding financial exploitation with all of the individuals mentioned below, both individually with residents as well as groups and resident council meetings and so on. Connect with local and state partners, which I'll talk about in the next slide, and increase public awareness. Get involved in the media. Write some letters to the editor. Post information about financial exploitation on your agency website and social media. Provide community education, and again, participate in World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, or WEAD, which happens on June 15th every year. So people that you need to get to know, your local and state contacts, the Ombudsman Program, which has already been mentioned, and every organization or program or agency on this slide, I've included a website so you can locate either your local or state resource. Your state survey agency, the people that go out and make sure that facilities are upholding the regulations and providing quality care. Adult Protective Services, local law enforcement. At the federal level, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Go to their website and see the available resources that Naomi already mentioned. Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, thank you for the chat message earlier. Absolutely. The Medicaid Fraud Control Units, they investigate and prosecute Medicaid fraud, as well as investigate and prosecute patient abuse or resident abuse and neglect in healthcare facilities. So it's not just long-term care facilities. It's also a hospital setting and anyone that receives Medicaid. And then SMP, the Senior Medicare Patrol, is an excellent resource for you to reach out to. And, of course, the Social Security Administration. So we have some new consumer fact sheets that we've produced, and they both are for residents as well as residents' family members or friends. The consumer fact sheets inform consumers how to know about knowing your rights, planning how to handle your finances, review your finances, and how to protect yourself. And protecting your loved one, those fact sheets provide tips about understanding resident rights, how to watch for warning signs, how to communicate with your loved one if you think there's an issue, and how to report it. There are separate fact sheets for nursing home residents and families and assisted living residents and families. And NORC also created a new document called 10 Things Ombudsmen Can Do to Protect Long-Term Care Consumers Regarding Financial Exploitation. And that will be posted on the NORC website and with these materials shortly after our call. So please print these off, circulate them, use them in your training, and let us know if you find them helpful. They will also be available in simplified Spanish and Chinese in the near future. So here's a slide with just some additional resources and websites. And at this point, I just want to say thank you again to Naomi and Anne Maria for presenting today and sharing information and resources from your agencies. Thank you all for joining us, for sharing your best practices and challenges, and for the work you do to protect vulnerable adults from financial abuse. After this webinar ends, a link will direct you to a brief SurveyMonkey evaluation. Please let us know what you think about today's training, as it's really important for us to hear from you in order to develop future training opportunities. So again, thank you so much for joining us. We've learned a lot from you all today, and we hope that you'll take this and move forward in working to combat financial exploitation. Have a great day.